Join the Toronto Holocaust Museum and its partners for a community-wide Yom HaShoah commemoration on Sunday, May 5th. A moving evening of film, candlelighting, music, and a tribute to survivors we've recently lost. Keynote speaker Yoni Berus from Yad Vashem will reflect on Holocaust remembrance post-October 7th. The program is at Beth Emeth Synagogue at 7 p.m. Register at torontoholocaustmuseum.org.
You know, when I made vinyl, I was 48. That was the first tiny bit of success I had. I had 25 full years of utter struggle and failure.
Hi, everybody. I'm Ralph Ben-Murgi. Welcome to Not That Kind of Rabbi. In case you've never listened to this program, I'm not a rabbi. I am an ordained spiritual director, but I'm not a rabbi. And if I was a rabbi, I wouldn't be that kind of rabbi. Which, by the way, some of my rabbi friends take deep offense to when I say that, because of, what do you mean? Am I that kind of rabbi? And I don't know what to say, so I say, oh, no. You know, there's no definition. So.
Did I ever tell you about Rabbi Friedberg?
Rabbi Friedberg was a Betzedek or something?
Rabbi Friedberg was a rabbi, but he also taught at Hebrew school. And he taught with this rhetorical device, which he never, ever veered from. It was like, today in my house, I have this guy and Ralph. That's okay, Ralph. And then he would be like, and then Miriam said to so-and-so, and then you'd have to... Yeah, she said, go, keep going. And then this guy did. Yeah, anyway, that was his way of teaching.
So some of you may think that was my inner voice just now. It wasn't my inner voice. But I'll tell you the first time, the person who I'm going to introduce, that I actually was in the same kind of room with him. It was the first place I lived in that wasn't my parents' house in Toronto, 312 Avenue Road. As you went down towards Davenport, if you live in Toronto, there's the big hill where people go really fast. And then there's this house with a turret. And I heard I could get a room in this house. And I knew one person who ends up being the brother of the person I'm about to introduce to you. So I go over to the house, and I don't know, it all worked out, and I was going to live there. And then I look into a room, and there's a guy. He's sitting on this futon bed, and there's a tapestry, a Hindu tapestry thing behind him. And he's smoking one of those Indian cigarettes, rupee, I think.
Beedi.
Beedi, smoking a beedi. And, you know, I'm still at that age where if I'm 19 and he's, you know, 22, 23, it's just like 24. It's like, wow, you're from another generation. And this guy had just come back from India and had the vibe, the India vibe going strong. And I thought, wow, I want to be like him.
Later, you found out how little you wanted to be like him.
Exactly. So at the time, though, I thought, wow. So this is the filmmaker, Alan, and the last name is Zweig, or as we used to call Michael Zwigger, which he never
liked. I
don't
remember the story that way. What I remember is I was going on a trip, which I actually went with Joey Axe. We went to Boulder, Colorado to sort of sit in on the Naropa Institute, which we did. Like I took poetry classes with Allen Ginsberg and stuff like that. And I was going to be gone for a couple weeks and my room was going to be free, and I had a water bed. And
it was
I thought you and your then girlfriend would enjoy spending a couple of weeks in my room with the water bed. That's how I remember
okay,
it.
Okay, now I remember that. But then I do remember you in a very South Asian pose.
Well, I mean, yeah, it is weird because, of course, I have stories that go along with that involving girls in that house. But yeah, that was a moment when I seemed older and wiser, etc. For a moment that didn't last, but...
That's what I was going to ask. Is there any residue from your India experience in your life, do you think?
Oh, yeah. There's a residue in that. In this past fall, it was 50 years ago that I got to India, and I am in touch with the people that I went to India with, including two girls from Texas who were very important to my, like, coming-of-age story. And then the two guys that were there in Vancouver and Salt Spring Island. Yeah. And interestingly, you probably can relate to this, when I said the five of us should get together, because it was a life-changing experience, you could easily make a movie about it. One of us ended up in prison in Iran for trying to smuggle hash. One of us had a kid. One of us had a schizophrenic breakdown on the beach in Goa, and I had to put them on a plane back to Toronto. One of them said, you know, kind of like, I remember this as a line of dialogue from a film that I always remember this, the guy said, a long time ago, I knew you for a very short time. Mm-hmm. So for him, it was like, yeah, lots of things have happened in my life. That's not such a big memory for me. But for me, was your dad in the war?
No.
Okay, so that, I compare it to that. How did my father go overseas to war, have his friends die, fly in planes over Germany? You would have PTSD and be dining on those stories for the rest of your life, and he never said a word, except he said, I never shot a man in anger. That was all he said. So I'm just saying, I did, this is 6 months of my life when I was 21, and I know it changed my life.
So what did it do?
I was on the Jewish route to law school. You know, in grade 13, I read On the Road and kind of like, okay, I got to get off this road to law school. But I didn't get off the road to law school. And then I said, okay, I got into Osgoode and said, okay, just give me a year. I think if I'd like gone to where I was thinking of going, like England and Switzerland and Amsterdam and stuff like that, I would have come back.
Right.
And gone to law school.
But going to a totally different culture, right?
On the road to India, I was like, okay, I don't have to do this for the rest of my life, which I certainly didn't, but I don't have to do that.
But you had a bit of a Dharma bum thing that you could go, life doesn't have to be this way.
Yeah.
We can look at it differently than the way we look at it.
And it happened, you know what? I think it happened. I named those two ladies Lisa and Jenny. I think that they were like older sisters. Again, you say they were like 2 years older than me, but they were from Texas. And I've found, maybe found this, that the people I met on the road from very repressive places like Texas and Germany, if they escaped that, those were the truly coolest people you ever met. I didn't have to pay any price in Toronto and Forest Hill to have long hair and smoke dope and whatever and be cool. There was nothing pushing back against that. But they had a big pushback, you can imagine. And they liked me and they encouraged me to be myself. They accepted me in some way, like what I was presenting to them. And then it was like, oh. That was, I mean, I could make a meal of this story, I'm telling you, but why did I need that acceptance? Why didn't I have that acceptance? I don't know.
Right.
But I didn't.
Right.
Just put it that way. I didn't think I was allowed to be this version of myself.
So you went to Sheridan.
Yeah, I went to Indy again.
Yeah.
The next year, because I didn't know what to do. I figured I'd go to York. I went to York and I spoke to this guy there and he said, well, I used to work at this place called Sheridan in Oakville. It sounds more like what you want than this. And so that's why I went there. That definitely changed my life again because York was a full-on, we make narrative films, period. We make Hollywood films. And some people who went there, like James Orr, et cetera, did. Whereas Sheridan, both the teachers were experimental filmmakers, so... That changed that.
So when you went to Sheridan, this is like, there's a lot of things where we intersect. So you start making films, and I've always wondered, why did you put me, you did The Boys, and Joel, our friend Joel, was in it, and Howie
and
Cooper, and David, and me. Why did you choose me to be in that thing?
I don't know. The thing was, my idea was to do an improvised, there was no such thing as docudrama, but that's what it was. And I wanted four people that looked like they could be friends, that it would work on some level. I was just casting.
Just boys hanging out.
I was just casting, and I just, it's like how he was, I think it was good casting. David was quiet. Joel was Joel. And yeah, and you were, I didn't know how much you would dominate, but that doesn't hurt the idea.
Right.
So we
did a few films together. Actually.
But what I remember is that when I finally finished the other film we did, which was, you know, to say I was over my head, like, that's not even worth saying. The other thing that's interesting about the other film we did, which was called Where's Howie, is that we made The Boys, we shot it probably in 1976, and we shot Where's Howie in 1978. In 1976, what you were wearing then, people wear now. But in 1978, you wore a sports jacket with a shirt with the collar over the shirt, kind of like leisure wear.
Right.
And it was like, that was 1978, period.
Yeah,
disco. That was like disco or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that film was deeply dated. Even by the time I finished it in 1983, it was dated. And I do remember when I showed that film, your then wife said, well, I didn't like that film, but The Boys.
Yeah.
And that's true, The Boys.
Yeah,
the was
boys,
a good film. Even to this day, I think it's still.
Yeah,
I'm. You know, I don't
how long
say
is it?
I'm proud of it.
23 minutes.
24 minutes.
Yeah,
and that had the. That was an incredible. Like when I was in the editing room, cutting The Boys, I made a cut that I really liked, and that was when I caught the bug right there.
Oh.
And, you know, if you'll remember, so it's just a coincidence. I lived at St. Clair and Christie, and the Mr. Donut at St. Clair and Vaughan had just opened.
Was it Pendrith you lived on?
No, I lived on, Ashworth.
Ashworth, that's right.
And so I said, let's go to the Mr. Donut that opened, and we went, the four of you.
That's right.
And we shot, and I think we did record some sound, but there was just a shot when you guys were waiting for it to start, and when I saw that shot, it was like,
yeah.
Oh my God, this is like, I've never, like, I, even at that time, I thought a lot about endings, and it was like, oh.
That's a great ending.
That's just a gift from God.
All night long, we're trying to figure out what we're going to do tonight, and we do nothing.
And, you end up,
and we're sitting
and
there
end
in a coffee
at the,
shop.
So bored at the Mr. Donut. Anyway, yeah.
I love it. So I heard that you want to do, I'm not sure you want to, well, I'm never sure you really want to do things. Because sometimes you're just like, I don't know, I don't and then you do.
Right.
Right? Is that a defense mechanism in case you don't get to do it? Or is it really that there's you got to get
no,
pushed
it's,
into the
it's,
pool?
No, it's more that, yeah, I mean, it's, you know what it's like. I mean, there's half of you thinks, this is going to be horrible. How can this work? This is a very bad idea. And the other half says, yeah, but you've had other bad ideas and you pulled them out.
Right.
And so I, in
you
the middle
start from a bad idea.
I think that my ideas for docs are all, I had one good idea and then I got really lucky with my, I had a bad idea for how to make it, but I got really, really lucky. And
with which one?
This Hurt, the film I made about Steve Fano.
Right.
I think making a film about Steve Fano was a good idea.
Right.
But I decided I'm not going to interview everybody that met him. I'm not going to do it about the run.
Right.
I'm just going to do it about him now. what happened to this guy 30 years later that his life fell apart. I'm going to film him now, and you're going to see somehow in the present everything that ruined his life. But that was the only, and that was also just interesting. I just remember, because I'm starting to edit another one now, that was the easiest one to edit. That was.
You knew where you were.
There was already, there was a story structure.
And you weren't saving it.
But I don't think any of my, I don't know. I mean, this is a complicated thing. Like, I ended up making, I made this film vinyl and I made it a certain way and it worked out. And then it was kind of like a template was born for all the rest of my films. And pretty well, and even my present film, when people I heard from the jury, from Telefilm, no, we would say no to this, except it's Alan. So he can make this film, but otherwise.
You know, I remember one day I was walking down, I think, College, maybe Bloor. You were in a coffee shop. I saw you through the window, and they had just announced TIFF. Or hot dog stuff, whatever. And you were there for the press conference, and you know, you were a big deal. And I went in, said hi, and you might as well have just run over your own dog. It was just like, and I remember saying to you, Alan, what are you going to be happy about this? Like, you're Alan Zweig now. People are just like, oh, yeah, this, he's great at this, you know? And
well, it depends when that was. So I would.
Like, are you always dystopic?
No. No, but whatever. I empty. Mean, you know, that might be like, yeah, there's always a reason to be, you know, a glass half empty or something. Yeah. But this is almost too big a subject. I always defined my life and my career in terms of sort of snatching victory from the jaws of defeat.
Right.
But still, like, you know, when I made vinyl, I was 48, right? That was the first tiny bit of success I had. I had 25 full years of utter struggle and failure. So I was very focused on that. And it was like, if somebody met me after I made my second or third film and they were like, oh, you're that successful film guy.
Right.
A bit of part of me was like, you know, bug off. Because if you didn't know me when I was a failure, you don't know me. Don't pretend.
Yeah, now you like me.
Now, don't pretend to know me. When I won at TIFF, the best Canadian film, not the best Canadian doc, the best Canadian film.
Right.
For When Jews Were Funny, I said to my then wife, I guess I can't define, like, I can't use that.
Right.
That narrative anymore. Like, this is too much success to fall back on the failure narrative. Nonetheless, I will tell you that I'm trying to do this one-man show, and I wanted it to be about failure. But my girlfriend, who's a director, is like, you know, a little of that goes a long way. And it's like, really? Because I could do hours on failure. So there's a part of me that will never stop remembering that. Even now, like, I'm making a film about suicide, and a big part of my whatever is like, well, I didn't kill myself, you know, kind of like, I didn't kill myself then, but I know that it's complicated. It's like, I didn't kill myself because my mother was alive, but there are people that do it with their mother alive.
Right.
Anyway, that's a whole other subject.
You're going to do a podcast called The Worst.
Yes.
So are you looking to allow or explore what most of us go, I don't want to think about it, it's too dark, it's too negative?
Well, that's a big subject. I will tell you this by way of intro to that. I have a therapist just recently. I keep not having one, and then I think, oh, I should go, and then I get one, and then I can't afford it, or it's too far, and I stop.
Right.
But this one, when I tell him that I'm making this film about suicide, and, you know, some people won't do it, and some people will, he says, those people want to talk about it. The people, They want, they have nobody else to talk about this
with. Right, right.
So there, that is part of my thinking, is just that, you know, there are some things that nobody talks about that maybe it would be good that they did. That applies more to my filmmaking than to my podcast. The idea of the podcast is simply that, I guess I think that, well, first of all, I don't think anybody wants to hear a celebrity talk about their new book and whatever, and how great it is.
Promotion and marketing.
Etc. Yeah. And I don't, and also there's that part of you that your friends, you say to your friend, how are you doing? And they go, just great. Everything in my life is going great. And you want to be like, I literally know people that stopped being friends because the guy told him how great his life was going. And he was like, I can't be your friend anymore. Like, yeah. So the idea of the worst was more what makes people feel good to some degree is hearing that somebody else has the same, like,
you're not alone.
You're not alone. Or even like, you know, when I have Schadenfreude, which I have a lot of, I feel guilty. But if somebody, if you tell me, oh yeah, that guy's podcast won an award, and I was so mad or something like that, I'm like, okay, I feel better. So that's kind of the idea, that it's not, you know, there's all kinds of joke. It's called the worst podcast. I bring the worst out in people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, it relates to, I mean, to whatever degree I have a persona or something, some kind of thing.
Well, I
made the film I Curmudgeon, et cetera. That title was meant to be ironic. It wasn't meant to be, hi, everybody, I am a curmudgeon. It was supposed to be a joke, but whatever. Yeah, so to some degree, I guess they want to play off this thing of me as a curmudgeon. But my thing is more, I've seen, I mean, this is, you know, your thing is about spirituality. So this is the one part of my life that is spiritual.
Well, how so?
I've seen people be affected by the sad things in my films. I've seen people, you know, when I made A Hard Name about ex-cons, people told me that, whatever, it changed their heart. Like, you know, before I didn't quite get that, but yeah, that's like an article of faith for me now. When I ask you to be in your film, okay, you don't, in my film, okay, yeah, can say no, but I really want to encourage you to tell your sad story because other people, it'll be good for other people. That's what people need in a way. they need something specific, not something general. They need, you know, I once read that thing, that thought that you've had that you think, oh, that's so horrible. Nobody's had that thought. Mm. You need to know.
Yeah.
Everybody's had that thought. So that to me is, yeah. So then it is embarrassing, my spiritual feeling about this, but my feeling that we exist in the world to tell each other our stories. That's our job, to make us feel like we're connected. And my films play a tiny part in that, and that's why I make them about people's lives and not about, you know, a baseball game or a famous person or something.
Yeah, and you're not looking for happy endings, you're looking for journey, right?
Yeah, I'm looking for whatever. I'm looking for people to tell me something real. I don't know, you know.
You know, it's sort of, by the way, folks, I'm talking to Alan Zweig, filmmaker, friend, and about to launch Canada Land's podcast called The Worst.
The Worst.
So I want to just move a little into the spiritual. It's interesting, you know, that Inside Out, the Pixar movie. So I remember showing that to my youngest, and I really wanted him to see that you don't have to keep telling people you're okay and everything's fine. Because that is the story's message, is that you need sadness to have a full life. You can't just be, you know, pull up your socks, go get them. And I think for kids, that's really an important lesson, because otherwise, I guess we just take our sadness out to the backyard, bury it, and pretend we're not that, because those people are not succeeding with life, right? So when I think of how that can become part of a spiritual journey, is the spiritual part for you the sharing moment where we're vulnerable? Because I know in some of the work I do as a spiritual director, you have to move people towards sadness. And also the other part is towards death. I remember I once wanted to do a multi-part series for the CBC when I was working there, and I went to pitch it, and they said, well, what's it about? And I said, death. And they said, what? I said, death. Death, you know, the music of death, the burial rites of death, the food, of, like all of these things about right. death, the afterlife. And the first thing they said was, well, who's going to sponsor that? And that was pretty well the end of the meeting, right. because anything dark.
I pitched a film about death a few years ago.
Right.
It's definitely a good subject.
And? What?
They said, well, the person I pitched it to had had a cancer scare, and they're like, no, no.
Really?
Yeah. They even said that they regret that, well, they even made a disparaging remark about Alan King's film Dying at Grace.
Right.
Like, I wish I'd never seen that, or something like that. Wow. So
we're death phobic. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, that's part of the reason I wanted to make
it.
Was,
yeah.
And I was actually hoping that my fear of death might mitigate a little bit if I made a film about death.
Are you somebody who, when we die, that's it?
Yeah.
We're just
compost? Well, that I don't, that might be true. Like, That it's the funny thing about that, I'm sure you understand this, is like, you know, the other thing of my identity is that I'm an old dad. So I was almost 59 when my daughter was born. Right. So part of the thing is you got to put as much in her as you can, pack it in,
right.
so that if you die when she's 18 or something, she will be
yeah.
a full of you. And yes, unfortunately, one of the things I packed in was sarcasm, which is coming back to
bite me. I do the sarcasm. But, you know, I have two sets of kids, and the second set, I was 50 and 53 when they were right. born. And all through this time, one's now 18 at university, and the other one's 14 in high school, and the other two are 37 and 34. So all through this time, people always say the same thing to you. Keeps you young. And I always say, no, it doesn't keep you up young. It just makes you not want to die. There's a difference.
Right.
You don't want to let them down. Like when I had cancer, my youngest was 2.5.
Right.
And I'm reading him, I Love You Forever. And I'm thinking, if this doesn't work out, I'm just nothing to him. I evaporate. I'm right. just someone they tell him about, and he has no actual understanding or memory. So it does bring an urgency to life. But I think that's a good thing. Anything that makes us
grateful, it keeps you
is
young.
Good.
It keeps you young only in the sense that by 65 or 66, you could possibly walk around less. But when you have to chase a kid,
yeah.
like it, my one-man show is about being an old dad. And I do have a story about playing this game with my daughter where you chase her and then she runs ahead of you laughing and then you run up behind her and she hears you and she laughs and runs ahead. And this day where, turned out, she had a gear that I didn't have anymore.
Right.
And then she's running towards the road cackling. And now I have to actually run, or my version of yeah. running, which is just... I wish I had a sound engineer just like banging the pavement. Boom, 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 boom. I grab her just before she gets to the road. So in that sense, that at that age, I wouldn't have ever run.
Right.
But otherwise, no, it doesn't. It doesn't keep you young. But whatever. It's just like in my case, I'll just be really clear about this. I always wanted a kid.
Yeah.
And all I was going to tell you before when you said about like my dyspeptic nature or something like that, it's still there. I can't get rid of it. But because of my daughter and my girlfriend and my career, I can say I'm happier than I've ever been.
I know. I've heard you. I've seen you write that. And I was always really happy when I read that, because I know if it hadn't, if one of those things hadn't worked, you have this sort of porous nature that things, you can't just, you know, have a shiny exterior and they can bounce off you, that they get in you.
And I mean,
you never had a kid, you wouldn't have been able to just blow that off. You would have just got, that's a hole in my life.
Yeah. And also, whatever, when you have it and then you experience that thing that you didn't know you were going to experience.
Yeah.
You can't imagine that. I'm like, okay, I know why I wanted this.
Right.
Like, I know why I thought this would make me happy. I was right.
Yeah.
And the same with career. Like the career, my career has not been very financially whatever. I've been broke for most of it. But I communicate like I had an audience. That's it was an amazing thing. Yeah. That's all I can say. When you went from having no audience, back then I would say, well, I make these films for myself. Why? Because I'm the only one watching them.
Right.
But then when you have an audience, it's amazing, actually. And not that, I had a Canadian documentary audience. I'm well known in Toronto.
Right.
Maybe, or something like that. But still, that's a lot of people. That's maybe.
But you've moved from grievance to gratitude. That's what I've noticed over the years. That there, in the early part. And
that's the title of my autobiography. But no colon. There's no
colon. That's right.
That's the life of it. No. Yeah. If you don't get it from that title.
Yeah. Grievance to gratitude. Wow. So what a journey, man. Like, what a journey.
Yeah. No, I mean, definitely the films, for me, it's, I say I have a podcast and I'm going to do a one-man show. I don't know if the one-man show will help him, but that's part of the thing is like, I just wanted to make films and I didn't even know why I wanted to make them. I just thought it was cool. And then I made a cut and I just liked making something. But I ended up making these very specific films that are like almost so personal and so just me. Nobody could have made any of these films. And then I discovered, like, I didn't set out to be an interviewer.
Yeah.
Like, I ended up spending almost my whole life interviewing people as my job. I'm not a good interviewer. I'm a good interviewer for my films.
What's the difference?
Well, this is what happens. My editor, I'm working with an editor who's never worked with me before, and she's looking, this interview is 3 hours. And I'm like, well, okay, I should have told you. Like, in the first hour, I usually get 80% of what I need, but I'm relentless or not. I'm like, I know there's more there. And so I will try everything to get more. And that sometimes includes talking for 15 minutes until they interrupt me and say something. So I will talk for 15 minutes to get squeeze that last thing out.
Yeah.
That wouldn't work on this. That wouldn't work. And I don't know if that'll work on my podcast. In my podcast, they are allowing me to not be an interviewer in a way. Because I always say, I don't interview, I have conversations. I interrupt the guests. I can't stop. Like, I can't.
Yeah, well, so, yeah, it's not.
So I'm not a good interviewer. You know.
John Sawatsky used to teach interviewing at CBC.
I have a story about him.
Okay, I want to hear it. Because I took his course twice. The second time was only 4 months later. He's like, what are you doing here again? I said, no, I got to get this. And he taught me format that and structure that I always have internalized, which was three elements to an interview: foundation, pursuit, and mop-up.
Okay.
right? So you start with, why do I want to care about this person, right? Why am I in this relationship with this person here? And it could be someone I've never met and don't know.
Are we on the mop-up yet?
We're in mop-up. So in pursuit, then you start, you know, truly listening and taking cues from what's being said. And then in mop-up, you can just throw anything at it. And what you're saying is that last 2 hours was mop-up.
Right.
Right?
So one of my childhood friends is Joe Solway.
Who's just retired from the CBC.
Yeah, and son of Larry, for people who go that far back. So Joe used to work...
What was it called? I can't remember what it was called. Yeah, I used to listen to it all the time. Speak Your Mind, maybe.
So
I used to call Joe, it Shoot Your Mouth Off.
Joe booked me a few times on Metro Morning, a couple of times when Andy Berry that was there, and also later when Matt Galloway booked me when I had a film at Hot Docs.
Right.
And one time he said to me, I don't think he said Sawatsky, but he said, you break all Sawatsky's rules.
Right.
And I was like, oh, okay, so I know this guy exists.
Yeah.
And I'm not surprised to hear that. Give me an example. And he said, well, Sawatsky would say, ask open questions, and right. you ask closed questions. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? He's like, well, Sawatsky, oh, your child is sick. How does that make you feel? That's an open question. And you would say, your child is sick. You must feel like shit.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah. And I'll tell you know what? I'm glad I don't follow Sawatsky's rules. Because when people ask me open questions in interviews, it makes me mad. It's like, my child is sick. How do you feel? Fuck you. Like, what the fuck do you think I feel like? Like, if I say to you, your child is sick, you must feel like shit. It's not like you feel closed. No, I feel okay about it. So.
No, but then I have to answer your idea of how I should feel. And you know you're on the wrong track when you start prescribing and the answers start with, well, no, it's I wouldn't say that.
Okay, well, you know what?
Right, then you've closed off avenues and they're trying to find their way back.
You go sit there with Sawatsky. I'm glad I didn't. I'm glad, you know what? When I started making these films, people started little by little telling me what I was doing and how I was breaking rules, lots of rules. Right. And I didn't really understand what they were talking about until one day I was interviewed. And then the guy said something like, you know, not exactly this. What did you have for breakfast? Bacon and eggs. Okay, Alan, you don't understand. My question's not going to be in the interview. So you have to say, for breakfast, I had bacon and eggs. Okay, let's do it again.
Oh, right.
And it's like, for breakfast, I had bacon and eggs. And then I was performing. And then I knew I'm never going to make anybody do this in my...
But you're off camera and you have voice up when you do stuff.
That's the difference, right? I work with the same sound men, but when I don't work with the same sound men, I say, I'm mic'd.
Right.
You know, now, there's lots of problems with that. And a lot of... To this day, I've been doing it for 25 years, and people still say it's a mistake for the interviewer to be heard. And it's like,
it's okay.
I get what you mean. I know what that's based on, some idea that there is not a person there and there's not a crew there. I don't care if you know that there's a person or a crew. I have no, like, I don't even know why that's a thing. Like, right. That illusion. Anyway, so I'm just like...
It works for you, though.
It works for me in my film. Sawatsky and nobody at the CBC would hire me. That's fine. That's why the podcast is a little bit of a challenge, because they're asking me to be a bit more like, and I will say, Andy Berry was, he had notes. I knew he had notes, but he was leading me through my questions. You know, the other thing about that whole way of doing thing is, so you didn't do it, but this dude here phones me the day before and does a pre-interview.
Right.
Now, in the pre-interview, you can hear by the way the guy's breathing that he's going, oh, ask Ralph to ask him that question.
Yeah,
I know
yeah.
that question is coming when you interview me, and then you ask me that question that this guy told
you
to write, and I don't do it well. And I say to you,
yeah.
You should have been recording yesterday.
Here's the worst thing you hear from an interviewee in that scenario. Well, as I told your producer yesterday, and then you're like, so I actually have devolved into no preparation.
Right, that's what I do.
But I've been doing this for 35 years.
Well, I say.
So I just go, what I need is to be present.
Yeah, I say, that's it. If you like, why are you so sure you got it yesterday that I won't get it today?
Right.
And also, I don't care if I get it. I need 5 good stories. If I don't get the ones you got, I don't care.
Like,
I often walk away and think, I probably didn't get his best thing, but whatever. He blew my mind. He took my breath away.
Right.
5 times. I don't care if I got every breathtaking moment.
So the worst, what is it you're hoping for? You sound ambivalent, which you often do about projects.
Well, I'm ambivalent because when I went to them, I wasn't pitching me for an interview show. I listened to their thing. I thought they don't do interview shows. And I've always wanted to do a show like This American Life.
Right.
I think that restored my faith in the nonfiction genre. So I was hoping to do that. But it turned out they wanted me to do an interview show. And then little by little, then they wanted... So the thing of the show is that I'm interviewing celebrities, but they're not talking about their book or their anything like that. It's like, this guy's talking about the worst thing he ever said to his mother. And so, you know, it's like if you just say, you have to talk to Ralph for half like this, I'm not nervous.
Right.
But if you say, there's a concept that you have to get to, thing that you have to do in the middle of that, kind of, I'm like, well, I don't do that. So I don't know if I can do it. And that's why. I did one. I was nervous. He was a good guy. It turned out, I told them, don't tell me who it is, but they put their name up, but I didn't look at his name. And then I saw his name and I was like, oh, fuck, I know who you are. But, I haven't been completely in control of all my films. So, I don't use anything that I don't want to use. I don't think about theme. I don't think about message. I don't think about metaphor. I just think about not being boring and getting, throwing balls in the air, keeping them up in the air till the end.
Right.
That's my whole gig. Well, so I don't know if I can be good for a half an hour pointed. And then on the other hand, I am worried that a lot of nice podcasts are boring, and I'm afraid mine will be boring, but they'll be happy with my boring podcast.
You know, different people work different ways. Like if I'm going to go out and talk to an audience or a group, my wife will say, well, what are you going to say? And I go, I'm not being disingenuous. I have no idea.
Right.
And she goes, how could you have no idea? I said, because it'll have to happen. I'll be in front of them. I can't just stand there. So something will happen, and I have faith in the fact that something will happen. So,
but you have experience.
Yeah, but when you do the worst, you'll realize, well, something's got to happen, so something will happen. You'll find your way there.
Well, that might be true. I mean, the first one was okay. I'm doing 2 more this week. They're not ordering a whole season. I'm going to do 5, and they're going to put them out there, and... I don't know. The thing about it is, I will say this, that I believe that if it doesn't work and they don't want it, I'll feel like, well, I gave it a shot.
Absolutely.
Because it's not my...
You could do another one called I Should Have Been a Lawyer. Alan Zweig has been my guest. Not That Kind of Rabbi is the name of this particular podcast. I'm Ralph Ben-Murgi. Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care of each other, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks for listening to Not That Kind of Rabbi. If you enjoyed your time with us, we'd love for you to subscribe to this show wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Ralph Ben-Murgi. Our show is produced and edited by Michael Freeman. We're part of the CJN Podcast Network. And to support our work with a tax-deductible donation, all you have to do is visit thecjn.ca/donate. Take care of each other. Bye.